Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and thank you for joining us. The Nature Conservancy recently acquired the surface rights to 100,000 acres of working forest land in southeast Kentucky and northeast Tennessee. Well, now there's word from WFPL's Ryan Van Velzer that the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust has purchased nearly 400 acres of forest along Pine Mountain in Harlan County.
Pine Mountain is a 125-mile-long forested ridgeline that runs through Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia. Kentucky Natural Lands Trust announced it has acquired 376 acres on the north face of the mountain. Board member Don Dott says the northern face of the mountain is steeper, captures more moisture, and is more biologically diverse than other parts of the mountain.
So you have a protected migratory corridor. Black bears came back into the state that way, and there are a lot of plants and animals that migrate through that area.
The corridor not only protects biodiversity, it improves climate resiliency and provides habitat for thousands of species, including nearly 100 rare plant and animal species. Among them are migratory neotropical birds and endangered Indiana and northern long-eared bats. I'm Ryan Van Velzer in Louisville.
So what about the possibilities of a tourism industry that involves Kentucky's scenic wilderness? It's a question that's been asked many times over the years, and maybe we can learn a thing or two from some history. Aaron Purcell is an archivist at Virginia Tech, and he's in Kentucky as part of a fellowship to do research at the University of Kentucky, the Filson Historical Society, and the Kentucky Historical Society. Aaron is a native of Rockcastle County and went to college at Cumberland College, and he has studied the historical record of the Appalachian region's on-again, off-again flirtations with tourism. We thank you for stopping by, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
And if you would tell us about the project that brings you home to Kentucky.
Sure. I'm working on a project to document the history of the Bunches Creek Dam proposal, which the Army Corps of Engineers put forward starting in about 1959 and reached ahead around 1965. And it ended up being defeated because of opposition from conservationists, mostly.
So you have studied, pretty much poured through the papers of Kentucky Senators Thurston Morton, who served from 1957 to 68, and John Sherman Cooper, also a Kentucky Republican, who served in the Senate from 56 to 73. And among these papers, you found many talking about the challenges faced by southeastern Kentucky, many of them still being discussed today, a half century later. Tell us what you found.
Looking at the papers of those two congressmen, we're looking at different topics such as environmental protection, the brain drain that was occurring in these regions, and the lack of flood control. Looking at those different documents, there's a yes for, and then there's a no against that each of the senators put together. And they were both very in the middle of the road. They wanted to see what the report said from the Army Corps to figure out how much it was going to cost, what actually were the benefits. And it really pitted the private interests of business. Many of the people in Williamsburg and Corbin, Whitley City, those parts of the state, against environmentalists, largely from places like Lexington, Louisville, Frankfort, some of the more urban areas. But across the board, people were kind of torn. They wanted the development and a chance to have a better economic future for their children, but they also didn't want to give up the natural beauty of the falls.
And would this dam have been downstream? In other words, would it have covered the falls?
So the predecessor to this was a plan in the 1920s by private power companies to build a dam upriver from the falls. And in order to control the water, they would have an 80-foot tall dam. Then they would drill a large tunnel that would go all the way to beneath the dam because there is a curve in the river. So the water would be diverted through this tunnel, thus controlling the flow over the falls, and the hydro plant would be downstream. this plan in the 1960s was basically the exact same thing. So the Army Corps argued that it wouldn't destroy the aesthetics of the spot, but environmentalists often brought in a religious meaning to this, saying if we start messing with what God had created for us, we're going to somehow destroy it.
And so who won?
The environmentalists won out in terms of raising their voices and creating enough opposition in Frankfurt. The governor's office and the legislators in Frankfurt ended up deciding this isn't something that we want to do because the dam itself was going to be built inside of a state park. It wasn't as if it was going to be built outside or further upriver, but that involved the state of Kentucky. So the Park Service was very much against it. And then the Army Corps did a report, and the report kind of lessened the benefits because the Army Corps wasn't about creating electric power. That wasn't their duty. They were there to provide flood control. The way that it was designed, it was supposed to protect Williamsburg, where I went to school at Cumberland College, from flooding, which still has that problem. But their report said it would not really alleviate a whole lot of flooding in the other areas that would be backed up behind the reservoir.
Hmm. So what we have here really is a textbook example of that collision between protection of natural spaces versus human development.
Plus, you could see the dam from DuPont Lodge. That was one of the big environmentalists' biggest problem, is you would be sitting there enjoying the beauty and the scenery, and then you would see this 80-foot concrete behemoth that was in the middle of the river.
Many in eastern Kentucky are having conversations around the idea of at least some economic salvation in tourism. This is also a conversation that's been going on for many years.
Well, I think the idea of opening up the area to more access points. The other thing that happened in 1964 was the Wilderness Act, which really defined what could and couldn't be developed in a national park or, in some cases, state parks, preserves, land conservancies, those sorts of things. So the idea was that the way to protect it is to limit access to everyone. The idea of ecotourism, I think, is to open up the space a bit more. There was always the argument with Cumberland Falls that you go and you see the waterfall and there's a lodge and a hotel, and that's about it. So the idea of developing something more, the Army Corps believed that with better regulation of the water flow, they could actually create a much nicer reservoir behind it, which would allow for fishing, boating, skiing, all those different things. Because, again, in the 1960s, it was very fashionable for water control projects to equal economic stimulation.
How can this history that you're studying inform the discussions that are now taking place among many stakeholders in the region?
Well, that's a good question. I think the pros and the cons of this project would pretty much be the same today. There would be a large number of business interests who would say this would allow a better future for our children, for the region, which is still economically depressed. But I think that there's a middle ground here, maybe not building a dam, but expanding some of the natural areas, more hiking trails, more tourism, if there is a way to do that comfortably. It's easy to look at some national parks that perhaps did a little too much of that. Great Smoky Mountains is a good example. There are many people who go to the Great Smoky Mountains but never actually get to the mountains. They're doing shopping while they're there. I'm not sure that is the answer for Cumberland Falls and other places that are natural and protected like that. But I think there is a way to do it in such a way to respect the nature and allow access to anyone who wants to come and use it.
You know, it's interesting. I've mentioned a couple of times that these are conversations that have been going on for decades, generations. But there is something different about this time that we're in now. Never before have we seen something that was taken for granted, coal, in such decline, if not collapse. So that big chunk of the southeastern Kentucky economy is being at least reduced, if not removed, which creates an imperative to turn to something else, that being tourism. What do you think about that dynamic, the fact that that's being removed from the discussion now and maybe there's more of an imperative?
One thing to look at are the census numbers that this area that I'm talking about here has continued to lose population mm-hmm. because, as many of the people in the 60s said, our children will have no place to go once they graduate high school. In order to be successful, they have to move somewhere else. And so the idea was this dam was somehow the savior of that. The idea of creating some sort of tourism happened in the county over from there with Big South Fork, which was also, and I won't get into this too much, at the same time this project was proposed, there was another one called Devil's Jump, which was basically going to do the exact same thing where they created the Big South Fork. And that is an area that does have national protections as a national park. But when you look at the amount of tourism dollars coming in there, I can't imagine it is significant enough to make the population of McCreary County and others there in Tennessee to continue to go up. So I don't know if protecting more lands is the way to do it. It seems like providing more access would be a starter for that.
Virginia Tech archivist and researcher Aaron Purcell, welcome back to Kentucky for your visit here, and we thank you so much for stopping by Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
We want to let you know about something coming up on August 1st. Our East Kentucky Home, a community conversation in Pikeville. It's being organized by Lindsay Gilpin. She's editor-in-chief of our Whitesburg-based content partner Southerly Magazine. And it's all about media coverage of important issues in Appalachia, from the environmental and health impacts of coal mining and the future of work in the region, to quality of life issues like affordable housing and access to basic resources. Lindsay says the event is an opportunity to help journalists find stories we're missing and figure out ways to more accurately reflect the ways communities are working to achieve a just transition in Appalachia. The agenda includes a workshop about media literacy. It'll be led by local reporters, including Lindsay, Sydney Bowles, reporter for the Ohio Valley Resource in Whitesburg, and Will Wright, reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader, based in Pikeville. You can get details on when and where at southerlymag.org. Or on Facebook, just type into the search bar, Our East Kentucky Home, a Community Conversation. Coming up after the break.
Imagine that everyone that was significant in your life used you, abused you, or considered you an afterthought.
Chris Peck of Mount Sterling-based Hope Hill Youth Services. He's on the front lines of an overwhelming foster care crisis in Kentucky. It's being driven by drug addiction. Mary Meehan has a report on a pain management alternative. And another organization on the front lines of the opioid crisis changes its name, and you'll hear why. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Now in its 53rd year since formation in 1966, Bluegrass.org has made a big change. The community mental health organization, with an annual budget of over $200 million and 13 offices in central Kentucky, has a new name, New Vista. Don Rogers has been with the organization for 24 years, and he is its chief clinical officer, and he's here to tell us about this change and what it all means. Thanks for joining us, Don.
Thanks for having me.
People may not be fully aware of your organization's scope in terms of your partnerships with mayor's offices, health departments, police departments, sheriff's offices, first responders, courts, county judge executives. What services do you provide to these government entities?
We partner with all community partners that might interface with any aspect in the community that relates to mental health, substance abuse, or intellectual and developmental disabilities. So as far as the court system, folks that are being court-ordered for evaluation or treatment, folks that are involved in drug court, lots of folks that are involved in the criminal justice system and court system end up needing services, and we link those individuals to services through our relationships with community partners such as judges, prosecutors, law enforcement. We provide services in almost every county in our 17-county region. We provide services directly in the school systems, and we provide a lot of support for the education systems to help address mental health needs of the kids in their schools.
This new name, which is New Vista, is that a name change only, or does it reflect a larger change structurally?
I'm not sure if I would call it a structural change, but definitely a change in emphasis and in the embracing of the vision of hope and of really expanding the influence of the organization in every way that we can in our communities. So we want to convey without any hesitation that what we believe is that folks have the capacity for positive change and that there is optimism through the services that we provide.
Your organization is on the front lines of the opioid crisis. How bad is it? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
It's very concerning. There's multiple problems that fall out from this that we're involved in. First is the direct problem of individuals suffering from opioid use disorder and all of the life dysfunction that falls out for those folks, criminal involvement and lack of employment, sometimes homelessness, all those kinds of things. And we directly treat those folks. But for every one of those, there are multiple family members, whether that results in a grandparent raising grandkids, kids that have experienced traumatic living conditions, communities that have increases in traumatic exposures to folks, which we know that traumatic exposure increases mental health problems and general distress in our community. So what we're dealing with is an epidemic of general distress in some ways. So, and the opioid problem is one of the major factors involved in that. And then the other thing is that there's a shift that is happening with the opioid crisis from opioids to methamphetamine. And so it just becomes complicated to keep track of what the nature of the problem is as it shifts. But we kind of see it as the same problem of a general big global distress of communities that just keeps changing its face slightly. And so we have to keep adjusting how we address that and how we engage with our communities to address that.
And you mentioned the word distress, and you have to wonder how much of this addiction results from the economic distress, the joblessness, the sense of hopelessness that we experience in the, particularly in the Eastern Kentucky region.
Right. Those factors you just mentioned, along with suicide deaths, all seem to correlate, and they all seem to indicate a bigger picture of distress than just this one aspect of the opioid crisis.
He's Don Rogers, Chief Clinical Officer at New Vista, formerly known as Bluegrass.org. He's from Bath County and also a very prolific musician. Thanks for joining us, Don.
Thanks for having me.
Take a moment to absorb these numbers. More than 26,000 homeless children in Kentucky. That's thousands more than Rupp Arena could hold. It's enough to fill 370 school buses. In 2017, 24,000 cases of child abuse were substantiated, and that's about 70 confirmed cases per day, 3 per hour. Kentucky's foster care system has seen a 35% increase in 5 years, and much of that is due to the drug epidemic in our state. Well, among those working on the front lines with these children are the folks at Hope Hill Youth Services in Mount Sterling. And Chris Peck is CEO at Hope Hill. He's here with us. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Chris, I just cited statistics to give our listeners some idea of the scope and scale of the dire straits that so many of these children find themselves in. Is the situation showing any sign of improvement, or is it just getting worse?
Well, it's really on two fronts. It's getting worse by the fact that more kids are coming into out-of-home care than ever in our state's history. This is not a Kentucky as a state issue. This is a trend that we're seeing nationally. I think you hit it on the head when you talked about the epidemic with drug. I think it's creating more opportunities for neglect, abandonment, just kids being an afterthought as opposed to the need to fill the addiction. It's getting better in the sense that our government has really provided more resources. Governor Bevin provided more in this last year's state budget that went to reimbursing us. Right now he's proposing that he gives the workers, the frontline staff, an increase in pay, which they desperately need. We're now more focusing on performance-based contracting, which means we're producing outcomes to show how effective we are. But we really, our struggle right now in the state of Kentucky is just really a capacity issue. Do we have enough workers to do the work? Do we have enough families to create this philosophical change from placing kids in institutions to attempting to place them more in-home settings?
Okay, and you mentioned something there really important that I want to get to later on, and that's documenting outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we'll touch on that in a bit. But I know that Hope Hill has foster care offices not only in Mount Sterling, but also in West Liberty, Prestonsburg, and Hazard. And we hear anecdotally of whole small towns in eastern Kentucky mm-hmm. that have lost most, in some cases, all of their children. Their mm-hmm. parents have become addicted to drugs. The kids sent off into the foster care system. Is that an accurate description?
Wow, that's pretty a stirring comment. You know, there's definitely what we see in some of these smaller rural communities, a lack of services within that community to provide resources to the family to keep it intact. I don't know about entire communities losing all their children, but there is definitely a significant portion of kids that are being sent out of their homes, out of their communities, that are technically homeless, that are living from couch to couch, from home to home, that are possibly living with grandparents outside of the community. So the kids are being transported out. It is a growing problem that biological families are really struggling to care for these kids, especially if the kids are exuding any type of a behavior that is severe or mental conditions that the family's unable to deal with.
Well, we often hear that maybe the most fundamental necessity in a child's life is stability.
Yes.
And we're talking about that fundamental being mm-hmm. pulled out from under them.
Yes, sir.
What is the age range of the children that you work with?
We're very fortunate that we have a lot of different types of services we provide. We call it a continuum of care. So we're able to help children from birth through 21 years of age. Our foster care program focuses really on, the infant to the 18-year-old, placing them in a loving home with a family that has stepped up to accept the challenge. And the kids from 18 to 21 are part of an independent living program where we help the kids through college. It's just really a unique opportunity to be able to help that wide range of kids. And a lot of times we're able to stick with that kid through the entire process instead of them, hitting one stage of life or level of care and then being sent to another provider. You said it, that stability, that consistency is everything.
Well, the children who come to you from circumstances that are so difficult that it was best to remove them from their homes must be terrified. They must be really stressed. Tell us what you and your staff typically encounter.
Imagine that everyone that was significant in your life used you, abused you, or considered you an afterthought. You show up on Hope Hill in one of our offices, and, a week before the cops came in, took mommy and daddy away. They told you to put all your stuff in a black trash bag, and now you're moved from, let's say, Kent County, Kentucky, and you show up in Mount Sterling, Kentucky with all your belongings in that trash bag, and you have a stranger looking at you saying, we're going to find a home for you. We're going to move you out of there. If that breeds anger and frustration and resentment. So the kids who are unable, who have never been taught to manage their emotions or manage anger, they act out many times very aggressively. Almost all of them have attention deficit disorders. They have a mental condition stemming from the trauma. They really just have a hard time regulating all these emotions, and that takes time.
Hearing that, I would have to think that you and your staff have to be very special people to handle that.
Yeah, well, my staff are, you know, many times what I say is what I do is kind of intangible. You know, I'm in the business office trying to provide resources for people, but the frontline workers are literally some of the best human beings that you can come across. They show up every day knowing kids are self-harming, that kids are not going to ever repay the favor of the time and energy that they invest. And they do it day after day for little pay.
Is Kentucky's foster care system capable of handling all this?
It definitely has improved. You know, we have this new program called Unite Kentucky, and it's a government initiative as well, trying to connect government issues and problems that they're having trouble solving and using really our faith-based communities to come along and support these programs. So we currently have a capacity issue. There's not enough homes. There's not enough workers, but it is improving. I think in the last year, nearly between 300 and 500 homes were found for families. That's one of the largest increase in homes made available ever in our state's history.
And if somebody listening right now has been thinking about maybe doing that and they would like to become a foster parent, you actually train them, correct?
Yes, sir. It's pretty extensive. You know, I don't want to scare anybody away, but we want to make sure that home is the right place for children. That's the number one concern in with me and my staff. But what we really do is kind of assess the home. You know, number one, is it safe for children? Number two, are the couples stable? Number three, are they going to be something we call a prudent parent, making reasonable choices for the kid? And lastly, we look at, can this family financially sustain itself without the support of the payment that we receive? So we want them to be financially secure where that money they're getting is not why they're doing foster care.
So what happens to young people who age out of foster care?
That is one of the most frustrating things about our job. A lot of times kids get to that point of 18, they're doing better. Maybe they're not self-harming. Maybe they are have really defined their coping strategies. And now for the first time in their life, they have ambitions and goals and confidence. And then they leave our care and they go back to a community that hasn't changed. Not many 18-year-olds are strong enough to do that. So what we find with most 18-year-olds, and the national data, it will blow your mind, 2/3 of children who age out of foster care are either in jail, homeless, or dead within 2 years. Those are outcomes that we have to improve.
Toward that end, and we mentioned this earlier, you have independent living apartments. I think they're located quite a few places, Mount Sterling, Berea, Richmond, Moorhead, Lexington. And you say that independent living support for young adults who age out of the system is life-saving.
Yes.
And given what you just said, I can understand that. But tell us more about managing these young people into adulthood.
We call it in our program the cycle breaker. So many of our kids are now second and third generation of a family that sent kids into state custody. So many times, you know, the kid is the first one maybe to go to college. Well, this program provide support for those kids 18 through 21 years of age, where our state got something right. They help pay for the education of the child. We set every one of these kids up with their own apartment. We fully furnish the apartment. We have a case manager that checks on them every other week. We provide independent living skills, so they learn how to manage a budget, how to clean an apartment. They provide mentoring. All these things are provided for a kid. It's basically like we're the support system for a child, an advocate for them while they're in college. And here's the amazing thing about this. All kids could benefit. When a kid leaves our independent living program, they get to keep, well, number one, there's no student debt. Number two, they get to keep all the furniture that we got provided for them, and they have a savings account. So they're leaving school with no debt, some money in their pocket, and enough furniture to furnish wherever they go next.
Wow. So we're talking about a lot of properties, material support. It must require a lot of funding. What are your sources of funding?
We receive a per diem through the state Medicaid plan currently. The next year, there's been a lot of legislation change where now it's going to be more performance-based, contract-driven, where we're going to have to produce those outcomes. So we're going to be billing these managed care organizations for services. But you're right. Private donations, unrestricted contributions, they really are the engine behind the independent living program. It takes about $1,000 to fully furnish an apartment. And so we go to our partners and corporations and churches, and we try to get $1,000 every time we speak to somebody so we can furnish one apartment.
In a video on your website, and if you would like to give the website address,
it's hopehill.org, HOPEHILL.org.
Okay, I went there, and you mentioned that people are tired of giving to things that never cease. And this kind of goes to what you were talking about before, about documenting and measuring outcome. And they and you want to see solutions. What sorts of solutions do you think are actually attainable?
What we have to do better as a state is focus more on prevention. We have to be preventative in the fact that it's not good enough that a kid winds up in our care, that they experience 4 years of being away from their family. In the state last year, we spent $415 million on out-of-home care services, and we only spent roughly $15 million on prevention. So for me, that really needs to be evened out. We have to find a way to keep kids in a situation where they're comfortable, that they're used to, and support that family. If we continue throwing money at something that has generationally shown no end, we're going to continue getting the outcomes that we've traditionally seen. And so for me, it's about providing prevention, and it's also about educating the public about ways that they can invest in a child and support us more readily. We've done a poor job of getting our message out there.
And you know, we talked earlier about how tough it is hour by hour, the day to day of working with children who are so stressed out, so afraid. But there have to be some successes, I would imagine. Do you have a favorite success story that you could share with us?
We do. And that's one of the things, if I could go back, part of what we struggle with donors is they don't get to see the changes I get to see in the kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they just see another kid coming into care, the kid that was her mother put cigarettes out on her in the paper, or the sex trafficking ring. That's what they see. They don't see a child go from here to there. It's just something that they're not dear to HIPAA can't. But there's one girl in particular named Brittany that came to our program just very locked up, just so angry. She would yell at me, cuss at me, spit at me. You know, here I am, just a guy that wants to just help these kids. And the anger is so great, and the resentment that they just can't even think clearly. And really, trauma creates this this irrational response to people. So she has this the first 6 months. And after that period of time, when we give them diet and therapy and they have clean clothes and stability, they start really starting to trust us once again. So we see these changes made in the child. Well, Brittany went from being that angry person to working on our campus to giving me side hugs. That's what we call it. We can't give front hugs, so we give side hugs to these young ladies. On her day of graduation, she was beaming. She has the best smile. She wants to be a nurse. She was going to go right back, graduate from college, get a part-time job, wanted to help her little siblings, be a good role model. And, you know, that's when we said at one point in time, Jeff, who's our fundraiser, said, man, you know, I thought Hope Hill really does give hope. This isn't just a tagline. We're helping kids find hope. And now Brittany's returning to a community with all this hope instilled in her. And we just hope and pray it continues.
Well, Chris, this is remarkable work that you're doing. We thank you for sharing the story with us here on Eastern Standard. Chris Peck is CEO of Hope Hill Youth Services, based in Mount Sterling, offices in West Liberty, Prestonsburg, and Hazard. And thank you and best of luck, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
Managing chronic pain can be challenging, and it can lead to the addiction Chris Peck mentioned as a home wrecker that leaves children without parents and in foster care. But one Lexington woman found relief and hope through a unique program offered by the Mayo Clinic. Reporter Mary Meehan has the story.
Wearing a crisp white-collared shirt, expertly applied makeup, and a stylish halo of silver hair, Brenda Peterson is the very picture of put together. But since the Lexington woman is also managing a debilitating chronic illness, there's one comment people should avoid.
I have permission from my doctor at Mayo for anybody that says, but you don't look sick, to punch him in the throat.
Brenda, an ordained minister, hasn't taken a swing at anybody yet, but the joke reflects the frustration of dealing with chronic fatigue and pain. Until she underwent rehabilitation at a unique Mayo Clinic, it's a program that could offer hope to Kentuckians using opioids for pain. During her time in the program, she says, she saw others change their lives.
And I tell people, it was like watching resurrection on a daily basis. Because these people would come in here bent over, barely walking, a young woman still in her 20s, shuffling like she was 90 years old, and holding her abdomen constantly. And within 3 days, she's straightening up, and in 3 weeks, she's a new person.
Dr. Christopher Sletten leads the Mayo Clinic in Florida. It's based on a treatment model first used in the 70s, but he says over the years, opioids and technology, like nerve blocks and spinal cord stimulators, became the norm. There were about 1,000 pain clinics in 2000. By 2015, he said, there were 99. He says his program, stressing exercise, meditation, and moderation, had an image problem.
If you can imagine a three-week program that asks people to come off their drugs and exercise and sort of manage their stress is much less appealing than somebody that says, I can stick a needle in your back and you'll feel better this afternoon.
He says the recognition of central sensitization syndrome, or CSS, is at the core of the treatment. Basically, he said, when in pain, the body becomes increasingly alerted to sensation. It immediately sends a distress signal to the brain. Over time, the brain becomes sensitive to those messages. And that, he says...
And so it forms sort of a 1-2 punch, a louder message from the body and a more sensitive receiver in the brain.
Brenda's main symptom was fatigue. Until she had a bout of bacterial meningitis about 5 years ago, she'd always been a high-energy person. But following her illness, she was tired all the time. There were other troubling symptoms as well.
Lots and lots of weird things, like skin issues all over my whole body, particularly itching scalp, a scalp that I could itch until I make it bleed, and it doesn't go away, doesn't get any better.
Sletten says most of his patients seek help from many other specialists without success. That was the case for Peterson. She was skeptical that the clinic would work for her. For example, she describes herself as a person with a lifelong aversion to exercise. And the first day at the clinic, she did 3 hours in the gym. In the end, she says...
And it is a wonderful experience. It's very intense. It's not for the faint of heart. It has to be lived out.
Brenda wasn't the only one who needed to change. John, her husband, clearly dotes on his wife. He watches her intently as she talks and laughs at all her jokes. And for years, he could do nothing to alleviate her suffering. The first day of Brenda's treatment, he was told that taking care of her was not his job. The words from Sletten were, "You're fired."
I don't have to talk about it anymore. That's not easy. She's not supposed to say anything about how she's feeling. Did you sleep well? I'm not supposed to ask. Are you feeling any? No, you cannot ask about that.
It's been a journey for both husband and wife. She dutifully, mostly, does the exercises as required. She practices using her new tools to keep symptoms in control. If she wakes up with a headache, she drinks a glass of water instead of reaching for the Tylenol. If the water doesn't work, she does some stretches and takes a walk. They share a safe word for when she's having a bad day and may need some space.
And mine is Lady Godiva, because Godiva chocolates can cure most any bad day.
Sletten says he likes to stress a simple message.
And the other message I'd like to get out, and this is an older message, but we fight against it all the time, is that it's not mind or body, it's mind and body. You can't have an emotional response without some sort of physical consequence and vice versa. And so the dichotomization of saying, well, if I can't somehow physically measure this process, then it must be a psychological malady, is really old school thinking. And we now know that even things that are not directly measurable can still have a huge impact on a person's psyche and functioning and lifestyle.
For WEKU News and Eastern Standard, this is Mary Meehan.
In a moment, this small Eastern Kentucky tech firm is billing in the millions.
We were able to figure it out. We're just a few guys from Eastern Kentucky that grew up and figured it out. And so I know that there's plenty of other people that can too.
Dylan Frost of Corbin's Ascension Consulting is our next guest. Plus, our great outdoors series with survival expert Chris Begley looks at whitewater. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In the words of Napoleon, if you want it done, do it yourself. Well, the French Revolution may not have arrived in Eastern Kentucky, but entrepreneurialism sure has. You'll find it in downtown Corbin. Joining us is Dylan Frost, who, along with Eric Lambert and Dan Metters, is a partner in Ascension Consulting. It's a firm that, in its short lifetime, has generated over $22 million in sales. Thanks for joining us, Dylan.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And we're anxious to find out how you did that. But let's begin by learning something about you and your partners, something that you all have in common.
Yeah, we're all actually from here in Eastern Kentucky. We grew up in the mountains of Appalachia. I'm from Middlesboro. Eric is from Middlesboro. Dan is from Whitesburg. And we all had very similar upbringings, right? We all went through different parts of our lives with single mothers through poverty. And have been able to grow from that and become entrepreneurs in this area where a lot of people look at it as a place that's difficult to become an entrepreneur.
Did you go to school here in Kentucky?
I graduated high school, but that was about the limit for me. I did go to community college, Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College, where I was able to graduate there. But education after that, I don't have. And I can speak for Eric. He didn't complete a college degree, but Dan did. Dan went to the University of the Cumberlands.
Okay, so I mentioned in the introduction that business has, in a relatively short time, racked up something like $22 million in sales. What does Ascension do?
Yeah, so it's actually over $32 million at this point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, started by learning how to just sell physical products on Amazon. The business began by literally going into places like Walmart and going through the clearance aisle. And just scanning with your phone products that might be in the clearance aisles. A common example that we would run into all the time is if anyone remembers a Sony Walkman or a Sony Discman.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes you could find one of those in a Walmart clearance aisle. So it just didn't sell for 10 or 15 years. And it had had a price for $40 on it, right? Well, on Amazon, those are basically collector's items. People are willing to pay $300 and $400 for them. So we would go through those clearance aisles and find a lot of other stuff, too, that was just discounted in the stores, but we could arbitrage it, flip it online on Amazon. We did that for many years, grew the business to the million-dollar level just doing that, eventually scaled it to where we would start acquiring inventory in different ways, opening up direct wholesale-based accounts with brands and manufacturers, buying the products in large quantities and reselling them that way. And we've scaled and automated the business ever since. And then through that success, we've been able to create coaching and training and consulting programs to help people start their own e-commerce business like we did, or to help support existing e-commerce online businesses as well.
Is it just the three of you, or do you have other employees?
We have a few other employees, yeah. To be able to generate that kind of revenue, it hasn't taken a large staff. So, gosh, I'll have to count on my fingers. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have 6 total employees outside the partners, yeah.
Would you like to see more businesses in Eastern Kentucky similar to yours?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a big passion of ours, is that we come from a world of limited opportunity. We had limited financial opportunity growing up, limited educational opportunity, and we were able to make it work through the resources that we had available to us online. And so there's so many different businesses that can be created right from your home. You know, I really believe that Eastern Kentucky can become a model, that this can be a model for other rural regions to begin entrepreneurship and to be focusing on entrepreneurship at the personal level with online businesses, online companies, and it can bring new revenue into the area. So much of the things that you see get done trying to support Eastern Kentucky financially, at least from the corporate perspective, it's a lot of programs and a lot of things that just move money around the region. And online business, online entrepreneurship, specifically businesses like ours where we're doing online retail, it brings in money from all over the world back into this region. We were able to figure it out. We're just a few guys from Eastern Kentucky that grew up and figured it out. And so I know that there's plenty of other people that can too.
What is needed in the region that is not there now? Maybe more robust internet access, for example.
I believe that's absolutely critical. And so people just need to be inspired, need to hear what's possible, and then really be able to believe in themselves enough to do it.
I know that you're looking for ways to give back to the region that you grew up in, that is now your home base. Tell us more about that mission.
Yeah. So a lot of people that have financial success, entrepreneurial success, especially coming from, you know, Bell County or other Eastern Kentucky counties, when they have that success, they leave. We haven't left because this is where we grew up and we feel like we have a heart here and we really care about the people here, the people that we've grown up with, our families, and we want to continue to live here, operate our business here, and then also try to make an impact in other ways with the success that we've been lucky enough to have. So, you know, I'm trying to make it our mission and my mission to support and try to find the next kids that were like us coming up that had that potential to create something great, and maybe they just don't have the resources or they don't have the access to be able to do it, and hopefully be able to provide that to them, provide that to anyone in the region that wants to become an entrepreneur, has the potential to become an entrepreneur, and we can help guide them. I would love to be able to help guide them in the right direction so that they can make it possible, because we really can create a lot of impact here in Eastern Kentucky if we do that. We can do it with entrepreneurship.
What sorts of things are you thinking about that you can actually do to advance that idea?
Sure. So I obviously know a lot about e-commerce, right? So I can help train almost anyone with a variety of strategies to be able to start earning money online. But not just that. I think that what's important is to find the fit for the person. There's so many different business models and opportunities, whether it could be selling information, selling training, support, or selling physical goods. You have a lot of options. And I would love to be able to have programs where we could find people and figure out what would make the most sense for them, what would work for them, and help assign them coaches or assign them role models, some people that can help them out, provide them the support and the information that they need to get started.
Dylan Frost is a partner in Ascension Consulting in Corbin, Kentucky. Thanks so much, Dylan.
Thanks.
If you're thinking about heading out for some whitewater this weekend, listen up. Time for our Great Outdoors series with wilderness survival expert Chris Begley. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks, Tom.
So let's start with stuff. What items do we need to make sure that we take along?
Okay. Well, in addition to your boat, obviously, which you'll have, the most important thing is going to be your personal flotation device that will keep your head above water if you get out. There may be other specialized equipment, depending on the whitewater, helmets or gloves or something, even a wetsuit sometimes. maybe a dry bag, something to keep your phone and your wallet in case you do go over.
What are some important differences between rafting, kayaking, and canoeing?
Well, those are all three really different things, and I think rafting is probably how most people approach whitewater for the first time. And it's a really good way to do it. You're a part of a team. You're going to be part of the 4 or 6 paddlers in a raft. You're going to have a raft guide that's directing the raft who's able to help you learn what's going on and do the right thing. Kayaks are very specific and really require quite a bit of training, depending on the kind of kayak you're using. Now, these are probably something that you would want to have trained with somebody that really knows what they're doing before you try to get out in any kind of challenging situation. And then canoes, of course, those also can be particularly challenging in whitewater. They're not particularly stable. They are also rigid, and so you have to avoid a lot of the obstacles that you might be able to sort of hit or brush off in a raft or a kayak.
Since this is whitewater that we're talking about here, is it important to understand that this is not a scenic drift down a lazy river? You have to pay attention to what you're into in the moment.
That's right. You really do have to focus. I took a group of bird watchers in the rainforest once on a whitewater rafting trip for several days. And, you know, one of the big challenges was getting them to focus on the river at the moment when we had to negotiate some sort of rapid.
To help with that, it's important to listen because you can actually hear when you're approaching those rapids again, correct?
You can almost always hear what's coming around the corner. And that's important in whitewater for several reasons. But one of the reasons is that there's a time when you're about to run the rapids when you commit to doing it. You can't turn around. You can't go back. You've positioned your kayak or your canoe or the raft, and you're going down. And so enable to give yourself enough time to get in the right position. The more forewarning you can have, the better. And, of course, listening is going to be a big part of that.
And what if we tip over the kayak or fall out of the raft or the canoe?
That's certainly a big part of navigating whitewater. It happens a lot. And there's a couple of things I think that are most important to keep in mind. One is keep your feet off the bottom. There are many ways in which your feet can get trapped in the rocks or in whatever is on the bottom of the river. And it's important to keep those at the surface. So you'll want to really raise your feet, head down the rapids feet first. And it's not necessarily intuitive, but you want to go where the water is. You may not want to go to the side. You might want to go straight down the middle where a lot of water is going to carry you over the obstacles that are creating the rapids.
Chris Beckley, The Great Outdoors. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
A shout out to EKU faculty who are among winners of this year's Catalyst Award for Innovation in Teaching and Learning. Margaret Zollers, Allison Connell, Angela Wood, Brenda Cottle, Chris Daniel, April Blakely, and Esther Tattershaw have all been singled out for outstanding work to redefine what's possible when leveraging technology to improve the educational experience. The award's provided by the education tech company Blackboard. And another stop has been added as the restored C&O steam locomotive 2716 lumbers through the region. It's a big part of plans to create a rail heritage center in Estill County. The 400-ton engine stops in Midway on Saturday, July 27th from about 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and then moves on to Lexington's Distillery District. It'll be there from 3 to 6 p.m. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or call and leave voicemail at 859-622-WEKU. That's 622-9358. We might include your thoughts on a forthcoming edition. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.